a good photograph, 2D or 3D, shouldn't just have a good linear composition. It should have a good three-dimensional one as well. And my favorite example is one I did on the canal project, and it was just looking through the hatchway door. And there's a very subtle difference on the right hand.
This photography podcast is brought to you by Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. Here is your today's host, W. Scott Olsen, with another fascinating conversation.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast from Frames Magazine. My name is Scott Olsen, and today we are talking with Tom Worland. Tom's over in the London area and in Britain, and he is doing some of the most unusual and some of the most cool work I have seen in a long time. Tom is he calls himself a visual anthropologist, not only a documentary photographer, but a visual anthropologist. He's got a whole body of work out there, which we're going to be getting to in just a second. But this is the stuff that just absolutely blows me out of my chair. He is also an expert at stereoscopy, at dual images that we perceive as one. To call it 3D is sort of the right idea, but not really what's going on. It is a way of composing photography, of viewing photography, of thinking about everything from light to subject to audience that is radically different than what a lot of us with point and shoots tend to think about. Tom, how are you doing today?
Hi, that's very flattering. Thank you.
I mean, Tom, stereoscopy, I mean, I've been reading on your website. I've been reading about this a little bit. So I remember sort of what this is. And yes, I'm old enough. I had a little ViewMaster and, 215, discs to go by and that thing. But that's not really what stereoscopy is. So before we get into your background, before we get into the more traditional work, let's just, for everybody listening, develop a working vocabulary. What is stereoscopy in the photo world?
The ViewMaster is actually a really nice example. It's a kid's toy. Yes, it's right. A kid's toy. But it's such a great way of looking at different things. And I've got a ViewMaster. I've got a few reels for it. And
those are going to be worth something someday.
Yeah, they might be. I mean, and the ones I've got most recently are really, really cool. And they're from the moon landing.
Oh, my.
And I had no idea, but they had a stereoscopic camera on the mission. It didn't go onto the moon. Now, there's famous photos that we've seen of Neil Armstrong. They're 2D. They're shot with Hasselblad. But they had a stereoscopic camera in the capsule with them, and they're so exciting looking at the depth of them. And that's the real thing about it. A good friend of mine, he shoots everything large format. And right. I love large format as well. Look at the quality. We all know the quality is beautiful. And I really wind him up because stereoscopic photography is better. he hates me for saying it, but for me it is, because it's immersive. When you're looking in a stereoscopic photograph with a stereoscopic viewer, there's different styles of them. Some are very expensive, some are very cheap. You are actually inside that image. You're seeing all the layers of depth. You're seeing things right in front of you, and you can almost reach out to touch them. And that's the real beauty of it. It's been around a very, very long time. It goes back to the 1830s, so it's pretty much as old as photography itself. And the way it works is if you were to hold your finger in front of your face and you close one eye, and then you switch to the other eye, you see your finger jumping in your view from left to right as you do it. That's exactly how it works. So the cameras have traditionally two lenses. Some do have more. And you can do this with your phone, with just a single lens camera, just by rocking your feet left to right as you take two photographs of the same thing. One photograph is for what your left eye will see. One photograph for what your right eye will see. And when you look in the viewer, your brain is tricked into combining them and you're transported into this three-dimensional yet flat world. It's quite special.
And it's not just depth of field. It's not just angles. It literally is a way to take a 3D photograph. but you do require two lenses. So, I mean, digitally, does that, you know, it's shooting two files at the same time that are somehow put together?
It can be. So there's a camera by Fujifilm. It's been around a while. It's a bit old now, called the W3, which has two lenses and it will combine them into its own file type. But it's getting harder and harder to dissect those in Photoshop. What I've recently been doing is I've been using Leica M10. And an old beam splitter, so it's like a prism box that sits on the front of the lens, to shoot two images into a single sensor. It's working quite well. I'm still sort of experimenting with it, but it means I'm able to do street photography, gigs, that kind of stuff as well, and still work with a modern, good quality camera and get these 3D images at the same time.
Oh, man, I want to talk about doing street photography with this, because that seems both terrifying and wonderful at the same time. But it's not just a matter of putting this funky dual lens, you know, on the front of the camera. There's all sorts of other things that you've got to consider. I was reading, for example, about baselines. Tell me what that is.
It's getting the heights right. So if you've got the two images side by side, if they're not lined up perfectly right, you're going to get them, you know, off center, top to bottom. So it's a case of lining them up. So what I do in Photoshop is I bring the little blue ruler guides down and I line up on something within the photograph, a street lamp, someone's eyes, you know, something with a very specific point that you can grab, the edge of a building perhaps, and just make sure that the tops of both the left image and the right image are lining up correctly.
Okay, so you have a basic element like that, but there's also the distance. I mean, the normal distance between your two eyes is an offset between the two lenses, but that can be adjusted.
Yeah, so there's an idea called hyperfocal, and it's quite popular with if you're photographing a landscape. Now, if you're just looking at a landscape, it almost looks flat because it's such a great distance. Mm-hmm. But if you were to spread the distance of your eyes apart, physically can't do this, but you would start to get a greater sense of this. And one of the coolest ones I've got in my collection is of the moon, and the two photographs were taken in different countries.
Oh my.
So because the distance between us on the surface of the earth and the moon is so great, you had to separate the left image and the right image by a huge amount. And I might as well be looking at a basketball. It's got such a curve to it. It's quite special.
Oh, okay. This one I've got to see. I've not seen this one yet, but it's now immediately on my list. And these were taken essentially at the same time, though, right?
I don't know. They could have been done.
It's not 6 months apart.
No, they are of the same view of the moon, so it's a full moon. But because our view of the moon doesn't actually change, we don't see the rotation of the moon to us. It could have been done from different months of the year.
Oh, okay.
Possibly. I don't know.
Oh, very cool. And the result of this really is a kind of 3D immersion. I feel like I'm in the scene. We talked about the ViewMasters. I mean, 3D glasses in movies, is this doing the same thing?
Yeah, it's the same idea. So one eye has a blue filter on the lens, one eye has a red eye if you go for the old cardboard things from the 50s, reviving in the 80s and 90s. That's called an anaglyph. But yeah, the way that modern 3D movies are filmed or created in animation, exactly the same. There's a point of view from the left and a point of view from the right.
What about the virtual reality stuff? People are wearing these masks on their faces to simulate 3D. Same thing?
Same thing, and it has the same problems. This is, as I say, it's been around a long time. It's been around since the dawn of photography, and it's in fashion, everyone wants it, everyone loves it, and then it disappears for a few years, and it comes back, and it might have changed a little bit. And it's true with everything else. You know, we've seen all these different ideas for 3D imagery, the stereoscopic view cards of the 1850s, the ViewMaster of the 1950s, the and the glyph, those postcards you rock backwards and forwards and the view changes.
Right.
It's a lenticular, but it's done with the same idea. It comes and goes in fashion. Virtual reality is that as well. The problem they have is you always have to have something extra to look at them. You have to wear something or hold something rather than open a book or go into a gallery. And that's where it's fallen down over time.
What got you interested in this? What made you say, okay, this is cool enough, I'm going to invest a lot of time and a lot of energy to make this one of my artistic outputs?
Lots of little things happened. I went around the car boot sale, so similar to the yard sales you have in America, and someone was selling vintage photographs. They had some magic lantern slides and so on as well. And I saw these stereo views. They were a few quid. And I bought them, and they were of the Boer War, so mid-1800s.
Was there a viewer too? Was there a...
No, it wasn't. I thought, wow, these are really cool. I'd heard about them. I've never actually seen one. So I knew what they were. And I thought, that's really cool. And I thought, oh, maybe one day I'll be able to find a viewer. But it's just a nice object. You know, there's a history, there's something unusual about it. And they just sat on a shelf for a few years, you know. And I went to the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, and they just done up their photography displays. And they had some stereo views there, and they had reproductions in a viewer that you could look at. And I looked, and I was amazed. And I was like, wow, this is how they work. This is what they do. So I was kind of hooked at that point, but I'd never photographed any. I didn't know how to photograph them. Mm-hmm. And then when I went back to university to do my master's, one of the projects was led by a photographer called Lewis Bush. And the whole idea of it was to rethink your approach to photography, to look at your practice and change something, to take yourself in a new direction or to learn something new or bring something new into what you're already doing. So I thought, well, okay, sod it. I'm going to do stereoscopic photographs. And I bought a camera on eBay, paid about £100 for it, I think. Got some film, 35mm film, put it in. And I started wandering around in London, in my hometown, photographing with it.
Now, is this just a single lens camera?
No, it's a two lens camera. It's
okay. So you bought a dedicated stereo camera. Yeah. Okay. Keep going.
And about the same time, I came across a book called "A Village Lost and Found," which is published by the London Stereoscopic Company, which is revived by Brian May of Queen. And it's all about a photographer called T.R. Williams, Thomas Richard Williams.
Okay.
And I looked at the photographs, I was like, oh, wow, these are really beautiful, picturesque landscapes of a little village at the change of the Industrial Revolution in the UK. The train lines are coming, heavy industry is coming, and that traditional Britain, as he knew it, was about to disappear. And that's what prompted this series of photographs. But then I've read up a little bit more about him in the book. And not only do we have the same initials, we have the same birthday.
Oh, really?
So there's me looking for a project in stereoscopic photography with a book of a photographer who is stereoscopic with the same initials and the same birthday as me. And then I find out that the village is actually very close to me as well. So I kind of had no choice to, you know.
The stars are aligning for that one.
Yep, very much so. And then I found out that Brian May was about to give a talk about the work in London, at Photo London that year. So I went along to that and I got to have a chat with him via email afterwards about it all, which is really interesting. And I started photographing based around the canals of Britain. So these were all built during the Industrial Revolution. They were part of that change that Williams hated so much. But we now look back at them as this sort of picturesque Britain, you know, with all the narrow boats and the locks and all this kind of stuff. So my daughter had just been born. She was about 4 months, 5 months old. And we hired a narrow boat and we set off. And we set off in the middle of a tropical storm hitting Britain, which is not the best time to try and learn to steer a boat. And yeah, it was great, and I met some wonderful people, and I learned about the canal community, which is something that's very important to my own practice.
Well, I mean, we're doing a wonderful transition here into your work as an anthropologist, because I mean, if you go back to Williams, one of the things you say on your website is that one of the things that attracted you to his work was he took a social political standpoint to the environment. This was a photographer with a point of view, and you're making an argument. Anthropology. Does anthropology make an argument, or what's the difference between anthropology and simple documentary work?
That's a question that if you asked me that a year ago, I wouldn't be able to answer.
Okay.
I've been trying to work it out for a while. I've described myself as this for a while now as well. It's about my approach to people and the subjects that I choose to look at and photograph. I remember when I was at uni, one of the lecturers and I had got into a bit of an argument over this. She wanted, for her, photography was something you would photograph the things you know about as a way of showing them to other people, a way of explaining them to people. For me, it's about learning. I like to go into scenarios or communities I know very little about and use a camera as a means of asking questions. So for me, the camera is almost like the key to the door. And then when I'm in there, it gives me opportunity to, why are you doing that? What's this for? What's the point of it all? And then start to just understand people and communities and life, really.
Oh, and you've gone investigating in a lot of really cool communities. One of them that I am mesmerized by is that you did a study of pigeon racing. and you know, that's one of those subjects that you don't know why it's so fascinating, but it is.
Yep.
So tell me how in the world you got hooked into that, and tell me about the project.
Exactly what I say. I woke up one morning and I thought, I don't know about pigeon racing.
You could have said astrophysics, man. You did it.
So I went online. I typed in pigeon racing. I found a bunch of different things. And I got in touch with the British Pigeon Racing Association. I believe
that there is such a thing.
There is. Queen Elizabeth II was their patron, in fact.
Oh, my heavens. Okay. Yeah.
At one time, she had quite a flock. And I never thought I'd say that sentence. I started sort of drilling down. Hi, I'm a photographer, blah, blah, blah. You know, the usual spiel.
Right.
And eventually they put me in touch with someone called Terry, who lived not too far from me. And he kindly agreed for me to come and visit him in his home, meet his family, and show me the pigeon lofts in his garden. And that's what I did. And then I kept going back and back and back. I just kept turning up. And I go to racing meetings where he'd be with other pigeon racers, and they would talk about birds, drink large amounts of beer, and eat chips. I'd photograph all that as well. And then the one thing I hadn't been able to photograph was a liberation. So this is the start of a race. Mm-hmm. So in the UK, most of the races go north to south or south to north or east, west, west, east. So I live in the south of England. So for us, most of the races, they would take their birds up to the north and release them there, and they fly home. I teach, same as you. Mm-hmm. So the idea of, disappearing for a couple of days up to the north of England wasn't going to go down well with my boss. I went very early one morning. It was cold. The grass was knee-high and soaking wet with dew. And I waited for them to release the birds. And I was shooting film, medium format film.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm lying on my back in soaking wet grass with a Mamiya RZ camera on my chest. When they pulled a lever, which releases, I think it was 5,000 birds. I might be wrong in the number.
Oh, my heavens.
Over my head. And I fired off the entire roll of film in those few seconds. And the whole time, I'm just thinking, please don't crap on me.
Well, you know, I see something really cool in here, though, because, you know, the difference between a documentarian and an anthropologist, the anthropologist is really trying to get at the heart of a community, trying to figure out all those non-visual things, ethics, philosophy, morals, character, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And they have visual representations. But, you know, it's a slight shift, you know, not a big shift, but it's a slight shift in intent, probably, to saying I'm doing a documentary study. No, I'm doing an anthropological study.
Yeah.
It probably affects choice of subject. It probably affects composition, right?
I wouldn't say it affects the composition, but I think it affects the way people respond to me. If I turn up and say, hi, I'm a photographer. Oh, okay, cool. They understand what that is.
Mm-hmm.
If you say, I'm a visual anthropologist. They don't have a clue what that is. So immediately they kind of want to know more and they will be part of a conversation with me rather than wary of what I'm photographing. So Right. It opens up the dialogue for the start of a project quite nicely.
And you have a fantastic organization out there. You've got a whole institute devoted to this. Tell me about that.
I know very little about it. This is still actually a very new thing for me to justify that actually, yes, this is what I'm doing. So I went and I did a short online course to sort of further my understanding, which was with the University of Queensland in Australia. Which is a really fascinating little course to do online. I've read a bunch of books and it's more about sort of finding a new way of thinking about my photography. And it's given me the opportunity to look at using tools that I might not have done otherwise. So to combine illustration with photography or to put my video work and my photography work together.
Let's take just a quick break. We hope very much that you are enjoying today's episode. The very fact that you are listening to this podcast suggests that photography means a lot to you. And if that's the case, you might want to have a look at Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. We truly believe that excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit readframes.com to find out more about our publication. And now, back to today's conversation.
Now, we should tell everyone, this is called the British Heritage Project. And the subtitle is An Anthropological Study of Traditional Crafts and Industry in Britain.
Yes.
So, I mean, the British Heritage, you know, really focus. It's not nostalgic. What is it?
My dad is an engineer. My granddad was an engineer. My great uncles were all industrial in terms of they were craftsmen. The eldest of them I never knew. His name was Frank. He was a professional golfer, but he made his own golf clubs. Oh. And I've seen examples of his woodwork and his beautiful inlays that he was able to do. So they were all skilled with their hands. So I was brought up with that being part of my life. If something breaks in my parents' home, my dad doesn't throw it away. He will do everything he can to fix it. And, you know, that's just part of my childhood, really, seeing that. And I've always been fascinated, I think, because of that, with people who make things and people who do things that are practical rather than just buy a new one or, you know, flat pack furniture to actually craft something. Mm-hmm. I find it mesmerizing. So I wanted to go and photograph a blacksmith, dry stone wallers, a smokehouse, all these different things that are there. We know about them. We've heard of them. We might not know they still exist. And the British Heritage Project was just a way of tying them all together initially. It was a commonality to them. But the more I did it, I started to hear similar phrases that would be used or terminology, and start to understand there's actually a commonality between very different fields. I would hear the same technical terms being used by a ceramicist that I would hear by a silversmith. And there would be a knock-on effect between the different industries as well. So one of the first things I photographed and filmed was in Yorkshire, in North England, dry stone wallers, and they're repairing the sides of the canal towpaths. And that area is historically would have been weaving mills and looms, okay, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it was also heavy industry. Sheffield's not far away, so Sheffield Steel and all that kind of swell. And then the Docklands of Liverpool and Hull at each side also. So I started to realise that the barges that use the canals would use the towpaths that we were repairing. And those horses needed to be shod. They need horseshoes and they would need a saddle. Those had to be made. And the stuff they would be pulling would be taken to the mills or to furnaces to be turned into new things. And then those would be used elsewhere in other trades and skills. So it was looking at that domino effect, as it were, between one thing and another. And I love that connection. So I started looking at more. And the more I've done it, I've started asking more questions and trying to understand those relationships between different things. And this has led to me putting together a survey as part of the work, which is still only around 30-odd responses, but it's looking at where people have found their skills and their interest in learning other skills, but also looking at where they see the future. And that's quite sad. They're seeing that the skills they are bringing to society and to the British community at large is less and less important now than ever. And we are seeing so many of these crafts disappear. We've seen the Bell Foundry, which created Big Ben, a famous bell in London,
right,
closed down. We've seen the last traditional ladder maker gone.
Wooden ladders.
Yeah, wooden ladders. There's no one left doing it. The blacksmith I photographed has been a family business since the 1860s, 1870s. His daughters aren't interested in keeping that business running, so it will likely die with him. If not die, it will be changing hands, it'll be someone new, but it'll be out of that family, and that's going to be a shame as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is important stuff then. I mean, the anthropological mindset is leading you to document disappearing crafts, disappearing, bits of artisanship. So at one level, you're providing a historical record.
Yes.
But at another level, you are providing a kind of argument for keeping this stuff going.
Yes, and I think we're seeing some are sort of reviving craft beer, crafts, gins, whiskies, all these kind of things have become more popular. In COVID, I think actually helped some of the smaller crafts and more people sort of took up knitting, crochet, etc. as well. So those industries, even on a hobby level, have increased as well. But the recent global financial crisis has now taken another hit with businesses closing down. I've been speaking with an old friend who's a ceramicist, so clay work. She's struggling to keep things going at the moment because no one's buying, because everyone's trying to keep things to the essentials. So is going to have another negative effect, I think, in the long run.
You're providing an absolute inspiration for the reason and for photography, for us to go out there and really make part of our lives a documentation of the stuff that is precious to all of us. Going through your website, I mean, you tell some great stories, man. If we go back to the barge trip for a second, after riding with somebody else, you decided to become a captain yourself. And and your first day out, you motored for what, an hour before you decided to tie. This is the bad weather, but then you wound up, with your hands underwater clearing a net from a prop.
Yeah. So again, this is where the canals are starting to fall into disrepair. And there have been like temporary fixes done over the years of people putting like nets over the crumbling concrete and brickwork to stop it, all bedding in. And one of these had come loose and it got caught around the prop. So it's October. It's freezing. We've gone past some floating dead rats early in the day, and I'm there up to my armpit in this water, trying to reach down using a bread knife to saw through a very, very thick rotten net.
That works well.
It really didn't. We were not prepared for this, and there was this couple walking their dog along the path, and the guy, I can't remember his name, I wish I could, he hopped on board, offered to help. He pulled his penknife out, he took his coat off, and he was there with me, and he helped me free it all up. And what was it? We got talking, and again, this all comes back to the idea of the community. Because the people in the narrowboats are moving all the time, is that they're continuously cruising, is what their license describes it as. And they have to do, I think it's 15 miles minimum a year, but they do a lot more than that. They're always moving from one place to another, and they get to know each other. But where there are people on the canals who are religious, they want to be able to go to a service on a Sunday, which will relate more to their community than a land-based church, perhaps. Might. There is a floating church network. And I love it. It's such a great idea. And this guy who's helped me is a chaplain for the British Waterways. And he just happened to be walking his dog when we fell into trouble. It was, it was a lovely timing, really. And he agreed with his colleague to stand for a portrait. I told him about the stereoscopic project. I wish I could track him down so I could send him a copy of the finished stereo view. But yeah, it was just a very lucky moment, really. It enters in quite a nice.
It does, and I've seen the work on your website, and that's one of the very inspiring things about being a photographer. How just our work, gets us to know such interesting and completely unexpected people in our lives. I do want to go back to the stereoscopy for a second, because you mentioned it changes your approach to street photography. And I would imagine, most of the people listening to this have tried street photography, or are completely dedicated to it. But you say, no, this is, slightly to the left or right of what you're thinking. So tell me how stereo photography affects, not only the act of street photography, but the way you're thinking about it.
It affects everything you do with composition. We learn, when we learn about photography, when we first study photography, either through education or just through opening a book, going to a gallery, we're looking at composition on something that is flat. We're looking left, right, up and down. In terms of depth, we don't really look beyond the idea of a leading line, And when I started working with the camera, that's what I was doing because that's what I'd always learned. And some of the stereo views worked. Some of them were very boring. And then there was another one where on a traditional idea of composition, it was quite dull. But when I looked at it stereoscopically, it has such a beautiful depth. And I realized at that point that a good photograph, 2D or 3D, shouldn't just have a good linear composition. It should have a good three-dimensional one as well. And my favorite example is one I did on the canal project, and it was just looking through the hatchway door. There's a very subtle difference. On the right hand of the two images, you can see past the hinge of the door. And you can look just down that gap. And you can't see down the gap on the left one. And it's just a subtle difference. But when you look at it together, it has a great sense of depth. One that's still now one of my favorite examples.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true with street photography as well. To see how people interact with each other within that space. Before we started recording, we were talking about John Mayovitz's work and how we both, you know, admire his style right. of street photography. And that great example of his where the guy is lying off the edge of the curb and everyone's turned to look.
Right.
You've
right.
got all those layers within it. But those layers are still 2D. Sorry, Joel. I love you. But to take those layers and to imagine them almost, you know, those old play theatre, puppet theatres with like little cardboard puppets.
Right, right.
It's like that. Imagine having all those characters laid out in those depths so you can look through them. You can sort of peer past them and see what's happening behind the other people. That's what you get with 3D photography, and that's what I think gives it great potential for street photography.
Now, you know, it just occurred to me, you know, one of the things people talk about with street photography a lot is bokeh, to have a real, you know, shallow depth of field so you can make whatever your subject is more present. Mm. I would assume that's not a merit in 3D work.
Yes and no. A great example of where it doesn't work is 3D cinema. I'm one of those people that if I go and see a movie, as well as watching, you know, the main actors and their dialogue and what they're doing, I like sort of glancing around the scene, what's happening behind them, the setting, the light. And if you've got very shallow depth of field, you start to get a headache in the cinema where you're trying to focus on things that are just not in focus.
Right.
So it does help to have a more depth of field and not have it too shallow. And my personal rule has always been that whatever my lens is, if it's 1.8 or 3.5 or whatever it is, closing down 3 full stops from open will give you the perfect point for that lens.
Okay.
I don't know where I got the idea from. It might have been something I read. It might have been something that someone told me when I was a kid. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always been my rule. And that's generally what I'll aim at. So I tend to shoot 5.6 f8 most of the time.
Yep.
And it means I can go a bit wider if I need to. If I want to stop it down and get even more in focus, I still got flexibility to do so. It seems to work with 3D as well.
Okay. Tell me a story. I've been reading your website, and there's a million stories in there, from the pigeons to the canal to, you know, horses. I'm looking at some of your concert stuff. Mm. I think there's few things that are more difficult than photographing musicians, because generally the lighting is so bad. But tell me a story when someone says, "What's the strangest thing that's happened to you, or the best, or the most horrible?" What kind of stories come first to mind?
Oh wow. I've kind of already mentioned it, but that day where I was lying in the grass with the pigeons flying over mm-hmm. me, there's a lot of weight in the air. And I know it sounds strange, but when you've got that many wings flying rapidly and they're all pushing that air downwards so they can fly, to be underneath it, it's almost difficult to breathe. And it's one that I've explained it to my students before as being a real sort of bizarre moment as a photographer, to experience the weight of the air being forced onto you.
Oh man.
Another one, it's not on my website anymore. I took that work down. I was photographing some hippies living in the woods. Mm-hmm. And there was a guy there called Rainbow Aaron. At least that's what he told me.
Okay.
I came across him when he climbed down from a tree with a hammer to make a cup of tea with the mushrooms he'd harvested. And he offered...
Now, wait. He's making a cup of tea with a hammer.
No, he's used a hammer to break off mushrooms from the top of a tree.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he's standing there with fake flowers around his neck, his toothbrush in his pocket, and a hammer, offering me mushrooms. That was an interesting moment. I did not drink the tea.
Sure,
thank you very much. Do you mind if I take a portrait? And then quickly disposed of them when he wasn't looking. And yeah, that was quite a nice one as well.
Okay. Man, I mean, you do a lot of you know, in this conversation, we can just call traditional photography. Mm-hmm. You do portraits. You do that kind of stuff. Do you find the stereo stuff or the anthropological stuff informing the more, you know, commercial or client-based stuff?
Maybe. I don't know. I haven't really thought about that. Something I'm wanting to do with stereoscopic photography is studio portraiture. And I experimented a couple of months ago with the idea. And that, for me, is all based out of a lot of the stereoscopic stuff that was happening in the 1870s, 1880s, was portraiture, is the Carta Vista, cabinet cards, and so on. But there was also stereo images of the same style happening. And that's something I've been wanting to sort of experiment with. I don't know I'd go so far to say that shooting stereo has adapted my way of photographing portraits with musicians or things along those lines, no.
Okay. Well, I mean, from my point of view, the only problem with the stereo photography is the fact you need that extra bit of hardware. You need something to see it with. But once you got that, you have a really, really intensely present image in front of you. And that opens up all sorts of aesthetic possibilities, not only for, you know, those of us that are shooting, the artists, but for everybody somehow encountering that image the way it's made to be seen. That's a, you know, breath-stealing moment for them, I think.
It is. I mean, you can free view stereoscopic images, so look at them 3D without any form of viewer. It's just by letting your eyes relax and let the two images overlap. Mm-hmm. With some images, it's harder than others, and I couldn't do it for a long time. And I had one arrive that I'd ordered from eBay again. It was of some geese in a farm. Very nice little stereo view. Mm-hmm. And I tried to free view it, and I felt like a popping sensation behind my eyes. I probably damaged something, to be honest. But ever since that point, I've been able to free view stuff a lot easier. So maybe I freed a tendon that was just a little bit too tight. I'm not letting my eyes do it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's some weird stereo views out there.
I bet. Well, man, I got to tell you, this is fascinating. I admire the work. I admire the history. And I'm going to go get something that lets me see these pictures, because I can't free view it yet, though. But thank you, sir. This has been fascinating.
Thank you.
Frames. Because excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit us at www.readframes.com.